This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Wir bei Vertex wissen, dass die Geschwindigkeit des globalen Handels zunimmt, was eine Steuerverwaltung komplexer macht. Und Ihre unternehmenseigenen Systeme sind nicht dafür ausgelegt, diese Steuerkomplexität zu bewältigen. Hier setzen wir mit unserer Plattform an, die Continuous Compliance ermöglicht. So erhalten Sie mehr Transparenz, mehr Genauigkeit und mehr Vertrauen in Ihre Steuerdaten. Sie wollen mehr über Continuous Compliance erfahren? Dann besuchen Sie vertexinc.com/de.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello. Today on the Moneybox podcast, extra cash for households in crisis.
Where would you be right now if it wasn't for that money?
I'd be dead. 100%. Yeah. Because I had no one, I had nothing, and I was out of hope, and this place gave me hope.
We'll hear more from Sam and our own Dan Whitworth in just a moment. Plus, the people who gamble to excess and then try to borrow more money. And why the Chancellor might have capital gains tax in her sights as she seeks savings in her October budget. But first, the Household Support Fund has been extended for another half a year, meaning local authorities in England and the devolved governments have access to £500 million more in emergency support for vulnerable households. The announcement followed the removal of the winter fuel payment for millions of pensioners. But while the extension has been welcomed by councils and charities, they say more must be done to prevent people falling into crisis in the first place. Moneybox reporter Dan Whitworth has been to visit Disability Stockport, which works with the local council to distribute money from the fund. He spoke to Sarah Crookdake, who helps run the charity, but he started with one of the people who's been helped by the scheme, Sam.
I've had two hip reconstructions and my knee done, so it helps me to go to those appointments where I would have to get a taxi, a bus, two trains, and then another taxi on the other end, which is almost impossible because it's well out of the way. It's like right in the sticks, whereas Disability Stockport, get me there, get me back.
I mean, that's obviously, I mean, this goes without saying, that's clearly a massive help.
Yeah, that's huge. It's like life-changing, so...
How else have Disability Stockport been able to help you with the Household Support Fund?
I was living in a hostel due to becoming homeless, which incurred charges of about £20 a week. I wasn't able to access benefits because of my specific situation, and Disability Stockport covered those charges, so I was able to avoid sleeping rough.
So basically they were the difference between you having a roof over your head and being on the streets?
Exactly, yeah. And that was for at least a couple of months. So I'd have been sleeping rough all those months. So that was like, it was literally life-saving.
That was last year, right?
Yeah.
Where would you be right now if it wasn't for that money?
I'd be dead, 100%. Yeah. I didn't feel like I'd any reason to go on, or I felt like I was just done.
Sorry, I need to stop. Sorry, say that again?
I felt like I had nothing to live for.
You feel that strongly about it?
100%.
What makes you say that? That is... a pretty strong thing to say.
Because I had no one, I had nothing, and I was out of hope, and this place gave me hope. So.
God. That's a... So when you say... Sorry, everyone's breaking out the tissues now, and I'm not surprised, because that's an incredibly strong story. And all right, so that's where you would be if it hadn't been for this money. That's how important that money was to you.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's where you would have been if you didn't have that money.
Yeah.
Where are you now? Yeah. You did have the money. You didn't end up sleeping on the roof. You were able to get to the hospital appointments. Again, all through this Household Support Fund.
Yeah.
How are you doing now? How are things now?
I'm living in a permanent place. I'm back on my feet. I feel much better. I'm completing the last year of my degree, God willing. Yeah, so completely 360 turnaround. Just needed some help. Just needed to be put back on my feet.
Sarah, I'm not asking for specific breakdowns, but with someone like Sam, how much money does it cost for you guys to be able to help him?
Everything that Sam has had, that's including the crisis support, the support to get to the appointments, the money, the petrol, paying the service charges, I bet that's come in under £1,000, easily under £1,000. And that, you know, that just that bit of support in a creative, personalised way has, and with Sam's determination, has turned his life around 360 in a year. And all credit to you, Sam. It's incredible.
Sarah Crookdig ending Dan's report. If you are suffering distress or despair and need support, including urgent support, a list of organisations that can help is available at bbc.co.uk/actionline. I'm joined now by Councillor Peter Marland, who's chair of the Economy and Resources Board at the Local Government Association. Peter, good afternoon.
Hi.
You run a Labour council in Milton Keynes. How important is this extension?
Well, I mean, I think you've just heard the story for yourself, which is phenomenal, really. And that's exactly what the Household Support Fund does. It allows local councils to work as they see fit in their local area and support people like you've just broadcast. And it does amazing work for a relatively tiny amount of money.
Now, it has clearly been good for Sam. We do get emails from people who say it isn't actually easy to get this money, and there have been criticisms it can be a postcode lottery because it's a discretionary payment. What sort of barriers are there?
Yeah, so obviously that £500 million is allocated to each council. There are around 300 councils that get it, and each of those councils are individual places. And obviously from a local government perspective, we wouldn't want to change that. We wouldn't want to make it into a national scheme because it wouldn't allow that flexibility. It wouldn't allow Stockport to work with that specific disability charity where they probably know they get value for money. But I do absolutely understand that. I mean, that was Manchester, wasn't it? Stockport, that somebody living in Stockport might then not get the same support as somebody living in Manchester itself or Tameside or one of the other Manchester boroughs. But it is really important that local councils are able to tailor local support to the very specific needs in those areas.
Mm, but of course, it's not always used in what Sarah called a creative, personal way. And she was talking to Dan as well about helping people with school uniforms, with car MOTs. But as you say, councils use this differently. I looked at one that simply pays out £30 every couple of months to its lowest income households, if, of course, they apply. It's not necessarily money that is available for one-off emergencies.
No. And like I say, each council is using it to the best of their abilities. One of the problems with the scheme and why I'm on the programme is that we have basically, as councils, lived hand to mouth for sort of 6 months at a time. This has only been renewed to March, and that makes particularly smaller councils it very difficult to come up with schemes that are maybe slightly more complex, and some of those do use existing mechanisms like sort of the benefits system to, say, distribute food vouchers or energy vouchers. But as I say, it's better than nothing, but we really do need to move from crisis support to prevention. And what could councils do with that £1,000 spread across the country, helping people like that? Because that investment in that individual that you've spoken to,
yes,
is obviously worth probably tens of thousands of pounds to the taxpayer in the long run.
And of course, another issue is that people often don't claim the benefits they're entitled to, things like pension credit we've been covering on this programme. Briefly, though, £500 million is a lot of money. It is a lot less than the £11 billion paid out in cost of living payments last year. Does this money even touch the sides?
No, but we want to move again from that supporting crisis to preventing it. And actually, if we could shift that £500 million into prevention, then we could save a lot more money in the long run.
Peter Marland, thank you very much. Well, the government says this extension is immediate action to prevent a cliff edge of support for the most vulnerable. And if anyone's listening to this and they think they might be eligible for some help, they should speak to their local authority. A lender has told us that a third of people who applied for a loan in the first 3 months of the year were rejected because of excessive gambling. Salad Money is a social enterprise. It provides credit to people earning between £25,000 and £35,000 a year. It says that out of 170,000 people who applied, it turned down more than 58,000. And over half of the people rejected had bet more than £440 a month. I've been speaking to Ali, who's currently in recovery from a 35-year gambling addiction. He told me how it all began.
So it started from fruit machines in arcades through to land-based bookies, through to online betting, casinos, then onto fixed odds betting terminals, which was the actual killer for me.
And how much were you spending on your gambling habit?
On fruit machines, £40 a day. Ended on fixed odds betting terminals, £1,800 in half an hour.
£1,800 in half an hour?
Yeah.
Wow. How are you paying for that?
Loans, credit cards, and then I would, when I maxed out all of those, I would put it onto my mortgage, and then also the killer of payday loans. So I had £2,500 worth of payday loans a month.
When you did that, would you be assuming that that was you drawing a line underneath it? Was that you trying to get better?
No, it just allowed me more credit because it basically freed up more credit for me.
How did it stop?
I went bankrupt in 2018. So I knew that was going to happen. It was almost like a ticking time bomb. But in the months before that happening, 8 or 9 months before I went bankrupt, I managed to get an additional £45,000 off my credit cards as cash withdrawals.
What did it feel like when you were going through this, when you were spending so much and borrowing so much? Were you able to confront what you were doing, what you were spending?
Absolutely not. It was like it's like being in a cylindrical washing machine. It just goes round and round. You're robbing Peter to pay Paul. Although I couldn't factor it at the time, very lonely place. I lost my career from it through going bankrupt. I've lost friends. I've had to reevaluate all my friendships and relationships, and including with family. But when you're going through it, it's because the words I used was it used to be. It's always been inbuilt into my DNA. And what I didn't realise was until the last 4 or 5 years since I've been in recovery is that actually it's to do with learned experience and what goes on inside your brain.
Ali speaking to me earlier this week. If you've been affected by addiction, details of help are available on that website at bbc.co.uk/actionline. Tim Rooney is the CEO of Salad Money. Tim, hello.
Hi, good morning or good afternoon.
Listening to Ali, you get a real sense of how it spiraled. He called it a cylindrical washing machine. Now, you use open banking to decide whether or not to lend to people. So you've got permission to see all their spending. How do you decide whether someone is gambling too much to lend to?
So using open banking, we categorise the data and we can see all of the gambling transactions that an individual is spending. And I hate to say it, but a lot of people are spending probably more than 10% of the decline population. More than 10% of their net income a month is going on gambling. But it does go up significantly from there.
So you can see a lot of information about your customers. What does that tell you about the kind of people you've had to decline lending to?
So specifically on gambling, we can see the frequency of the gambling, the amounts that are being spent. And those figures are truly horrific. You know, Ali just spoke about the amount that he was spending. We can see people spending thousands of pounds a month fueled by lending in very short periods of time as well, which is very disconcerting.
And does any of that give you an idea that this is an addictive form of gambling rather than just somebody perhaps, you know, blowing some money on a hobby?
Sure. I mean, this isn't a fun flutter. This isn't someone buying a lottery ticket. This is people spending, you know, small amounts of money over many hours of the day, particularly around payday, with online gambling companies.
Now, you're seeing quite a significant rise in the number of people who apply for credit who you consider to be gambling excessively. So I was looking at your numbers. You rejected 25% for that reason in 2022, 29% last year, and now 33%. What's behind that jump?
Well, there are more applicants coming to Salad, but I think there is more types of gambling and the availability of gambling for consumers, from handheld device gambling to going on to betting providers. And I think there has been, and we've seen, a rise in large sporting bet type organisations making offers to individuals.
Now, UK Finance, which represents lenders, says its members must comply with strict regulatory rules when it comes to working out if someone can afford credit. Do you see people who you reject for loans going on to get credit elsewhere?
We do. One of the benefits of open banking is that we can see all of those transactions in up to 2 years' worth of data. And we can see that the gambling of these individuals has been fueled by lending from other lenders. I mean, credit bureau data is completely ineffective at identifying gambling expenditure. So it's one of the real black holes at the moment in treating a customer fairly and making an affordable lending decision.
But with open banking, you can see that when you reject them, money comes in from another lender and gets spent the same way.
We can indeed see that.
Well, the Gambling Commission told us it is doing work on this. In 2022, it strengthened rules on what gambling harm indicators operators should look for in customers, such as the time and amount spent and what actions should be taken. For example, cutting off gambling. Tim Rooney, thank you very much for joining us. We'll be looking more at the financial impact of gambling on Moneybox Live on Wednesday. And you can also hear more then of that conversation with Ali. Do get in touch if you've got a question or maybe a comment about gambling that you want to share. The address is moneybox@bbc.co.uk. Now, there's been a big update this week on a story that we've been following pretty closely over the last few months. It's all to do with the ongoing fight against fraud in the UK. Dan is with me now and has the details. Dan, what do we know?
OK, Fliss, so on Monday the 7th of October, new mandatory rules for the finance industry come into force, and they're replacing a much smaller voluntary scheme. Now, they'll strengthen protections for victims of authorised push payment fraud. That's when people are conned, they're groomed, or they're tricked into transferring money to criminals. Now, the main rule is that nearly all victims of this type of fraud will be reimbursed to a maximum of £415,000. The idea is, if banks and finance companies are held liable for the money stolen this way, well, the idea is they'll do more to stop it from happening in the first place. Mm. But just a few days ago, the finance watchdog in charge of all of this, the Payment Systems Regulator, or PSR, announced a two-week consultation about dropping that refund limit from £415,000 to just £85,000 instead.
That is quite a bit less.
It is, but the PSR says over 99% of victims would still be protected whilst managing the risks to the banking sector that come from a higher limit. But here's what Lisa Webb from Consumer Group Which told me.
If the PSR makes this U-turn, it could have a devastating impact on the victims of high-value fraud like investment scams and house purchases. The regulator really must stick to its original plan to protect victims of those types of high-value scams. And if this government's serious about fighting fraud, it has to support the implementation of the new reimbursement scheme in full and on the 7th of October.
Now, the finance industry has welcomed this consultation, saying a higher refund cap could drive some firms out of business. The Treasury, meanwhile, told me this is a matter for the Payment Systems Regulator, as it seeks to strike a balance between, on the one hand, protecting fraud victims and, on the other, managing the impact on industry.
Dan, thank you very much. And there'll be lots more on this in a special Moneybox programme on Saturday, the 5th of October, just before those new rules come into force. Do get in touch with us if you've been affected by a scam. Now, we're just weeks away from the new government's first budget, but maybe don't go expecting many giveaways. Labour has made it clear raising money is the priority to plug what it says is a £22 billion black hole left by the previous Conservative government. So where might the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, look for money, especially when hikes in income tax and national insurance have both been ruled out? Well, on Moneybox, over the next few weeks, we will look at some of the possible contenders, from capital gains tax to pensions relief and inheritance tax. We started by asking people in Liverpool city centre what they thought about possible tax rises.
I don't think they'll mess with inheritance tax, not too much. There'll be too much of an outcry. Capital gains, yeah, possibly. I mean, if people have got second and third properties, yeah, bring it on.
I do think that they will change the capital gains tax. And while I don't agree in some things, I agreed that maybe it could go up to the rate of your income tax. The more you've got, the more you might pay. I don't think they should change the inheritance tax for the worse, because I do feel that we've already paid our taxes. And I think that whether you're rich or you're poor or whatever, I don't think that should change, no.
I don't mind if they put taxes up but increase spending in social care and, you know, hospitals and all that, you know. People don't mind paying for things if they're going to get a good service, that's what I think.
Well, lots of thoughts from Liverpool. The Treasury told us difficult decisions do lie ahead and that they will be taken at the budget in the round. Let's talk to Kirsty Stone, who's a partner at the Independent Financial Advisors, the private office. Kirsty, hello.
Hi.
Just paint a picture here. What has the government ruled out doing and what tax levers could it still pull?
Yeah, so as we've already said, so Labour manifesto essentially said they want to focus on protecting working people. So ultimately aren't looking to change income tax or national insurance rates, but that leaves just a few other options, and capital gains tax is certainly one option.
Yes, we will be looking at the options still on the table over the next few weeks. But OK, capital gains tax then. Just explain how it works and who pays it.
Yep, so capital gains tax is a tax you pay when you essentially make a profit and sell that profit. So that can include things like second properties, investments you might have that aren't in an ISA or a pension, and also some business owners that are selling their businesses.
Now, Annie emailed us asking, can the Chancellor make changes that take place immediately, so the day of the budget? Or she says, can it only start in the new tax year?
Really important question and on a lot of people's minds at the moment. So the short answer is that, yes, they could, in theory, change this overnight. George Osborne looked to do that and actually enacted that in 2010. So there is precedent there. It is something that isn't taken lightly and is very unusual. Normally, a change will be enacted in kind of the 5th of April, your new tax year. But in light of the urgency in terms of raising that capital, the government may look to do it sooner.
Why might that be an attractive way to raise money for the Treasury?
There's essentially some things people could look to do between now and the new financial year in order to pay tax at the current rate of capital gains tax. So people could look to sell investments or sell their properties at a quicker pace and then really kind of realise the tax that they know is due now, which is likely to be lower than any changes that come forward.
Mm. And why do you think the Treasury might be looking at this as the tax it might want to consider?
Ultimately, at the moment, so capital gains tax is at a rate of 10 or 20% on your investments and 18 or 28% on property. So there's lots of arguments to say perhaps that could be in line with income tax, which is obviously almost double what people are paying at the moment. So that is quite an attractive opportunity. And also, as some of the people you interviewed earlier said, it is a tax that appears to be a tax for the wealthiest individuals in society.
And what are the arguments against it? Because some of our listeners are concerned. Mark has messaged us on X to say, bear in mind when CGT, capital gains tax, was last at 40%, investors simply didn't cash in investments unless absolutely necessary.
There's exactly that argument. So essentially people could say, I don't need to actually pay tax on this. I can let my investments grow and grow. And then if it becomes more beneficial and tax comes down in the future, I'll look to sell it then. So there's that argument. And also, in the same way that inheritance tax is incredibly controversial and emotive, there is an argument that people have paid income tax on their income and salary in order to make these investments or build these properties. So some people may argue that that is a double taxation on working people.
Although, of course, things like properties rising in value, people might make the counter argument to that.
Definitely.
Are you seeing your clients trying to get ready now for whatever might be in the budget next month?
Definitely. And we always take the stance that you can only go on what is known at the moment. So we can only make decisions on what we know. But if we're weighing up risk in terms of what tax might change, capital gains tax is certainly high on the agenda. So people are approaching us for advice on what they could look to do now. And if that really matches with what they were already planning planning on doing in life. So people aren't necessarily making big life decisions on what they don't know is going to change. But if they were already planning on doing something, they may choose to do that sooner rather than later.
So they're speeding up rather than changing their plans.
Exactly that, yeah.
Kirsty Stone, thank you very much. And as we count down to that autumn budget on October the 30th, we would like to hear from you. We'd like your questions about what might be in it and what that might mean for your finances. Or maybe get in touch because you think there's a tax you think should go up. You can email moneybox@bbc.co.uk. Do include a phone number if you can. Well, one thing that sadly can't go up is our time here on the Moneybox podcast. So that is all for today. Please don't forget to contact us with any money stories you want us to look at. We really do read every email. Today, the reporter was Dan Whitworth, researchers Joe Krasner and Catherine Lund, studio manager Chris Mather. Our editor is Jess Quayle. I'm Felicity Hannah, and this was a BBC News Money and Work production for BBC Sounds.
BBC Sounds, music, radio, podcasts.
Humanity's journey to understanding the body has been a gory one, littered with unethical experiments, unintended consequences, and unimaginable pain.
In The Human Subject from BBC Radio 4, we investigate the stories of the discoveries that came at great human cost, but ones that also saved countless lives.
I'm Dr. Julia Shaw.
And I'm Dr. Adam Rutherford. And in this series, we're going to investigate the threads connecting modern-day medicine to its often brutal origins.
And reveal the untold stories of the people who endured them.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.